maniac. A maniac. The word had refinement and the weight of medical diagnosis. All these years she had known him, and that was what he had been. When she was little, he used to carry her on his back and pretend to be a beast. She had been alone with him many times at the swimming hole where he taught her one summer how to tread water and do the breaststroke. Now his condition was named, she felt a certain consolation, though the mystery of the fountain episode deepened. She had already decided not to tell that story, suspecting that the explanation was simple and that it would be better not to expose her ignorance. "What's your sister going to do?" "I just don't know." Again, she did not mention that she dreaded her next meeting with Cecilia. "Do you know, on our first afternoon, I thought he was a monster when I heard him shouting at the twins by the swimming pool." Bryony tried to recall similar moments when the symptoms of mania might have been observed. She said, "He's always pretended to be rather nice. He's deceived us for years." The change of subject had worked the trick, for the area around Lola's eyes, which had been inflamed, was freckly and pale once more, and she was very much her old self. She took Bryony's hand. "I think the police should know about him." The constable in the village was a kindly man with a waxed moustache whose wife kept hens and delivered fresh eggs on her bicycle. Communicating the letter and its word, even spelling it out backward for him, was inconceivable. She went to move her hand away, but Lola tightened her grip and seemed to read the younger girl's mind. "We just need to show them the letter." "She might not agree to it." "I bet she will. Maniacs can attack anyone." Lola looked suddenly thoughtful and seemed about to tell her cousin something new. But instead she sprang away and took up Bryony's hairbrush and stood in front of the mirror vigorously brushing out her hair. She had barely started when they heard Mrs. Tallis calling them down to dinner. Lola was immediately petulant, and Bryony assumed that these rapid changes of mood were part of her recent upset. "It's hopeless. I'm nowhere near ready," she said, close to tears again. "I haven't even started on my face." "I'll go down now," Bryony soothed her. "I'll tell them you'll be a little while yet." But Lola was already on her way out the room and did not seem to hear. After Bryony tidied her hair, she remained in front of the mirror, studying her own face, wondering what she might do when she came to start on it, which she knew she must one day soon. Another demand on her time. At least she had no freckles to conceal or soften, and that surely saved labour. Long ago, at the age of 10, she decided that lipstick made her seem clownish. That notion was due for revision. But not yet, when there was so much else to consider. She stood by the desk and absently replaced the top of her fountain pen. Writing a story was a hopeless, puny enterprise when such powerful and chaotic forces were turning about her, and when all day long successive events had absorbed or transformed what had gone before. There was an old lady who swallowed a fly. She wondered whether she had made a terrible mistake by confiding in her cousin. Cecilia would hardly be pleased if excitable Lola started flaunting her knowledge of Robbie's note. And how was it possible to go downstairs now and be at table with a maniac? If the police made an arrest, she, Bryony, might be made to appear in court and say the word aloud, in proof. Reluctantly, she left her room and made her way along the gloomy panelled corridor to the head of the stairs where she paused to listen. The voices were still in the drawing room. She heard her mother's and Mr. Marshall's, and then, separately, the twins talking to each other. No Cecilia, then. No maniac. Bryony felt her heart rate rise as she began her unwilling descent. Her life had ceased to be simple. Only 3 days ago she was finishing off the trials of Arabella and waiting for her cousins. She had wanted everything to be different, and here it was. And not only was it bad, it was about to get worse. She stopped again on the first landing to consolidate a scheme. She would keep well clear of her skittish cousin, not even catch her eye. She could not afford to be drawn into a conspiracy, nor did she wish to prompt a disastrous outburst. And Cecilia, whom she ought to protect, she dared not go near. Robbie, obviously, she should avoid for safety's sake. Her mother, with her fussing, would not be helpful. It would be impossible to think straight in her presence. It was the twins she should go for. They would be her refuge. She would stay close and look after them. These summer dinners always started so late. It was past 10 o'clock, and the boys would be tired. And otherwise, she should be sociable with Mr. Marshall and ask him about sweets. Who thought them up? How they got made? It was a coward's plan, but she could think of no other. With dinner about to be served, this was hardly the moment to be summoning P.C. Vokins from the village. She continued down the stairs. She should have advised Lola to change in order to conceal the scratch on her arm. Being asked about it might start her crying again. But then it would probably have been impossible to talk her out of a dress that made it so difficult to walk. Attaining adulthood was all about the eager acceptance of such impediments. She herself was taking them on. It wasn't her scratch, but she felt responsible for it and for everything that was about to happen. When her father was home, the household settled around a fixed point. He organized nothing. He didn't go about the house worrying on other people's behalf. He rarely told anyone what to do. In fact, he mostly sat in the library. But his presence imposed order and allowed freedom. Burdens were lifted. When he was there, it no longer mattered that her mother retreated to her bedroom. It was enough that he was downstairs with a book on his lap. When he took his place at the dining table, calm, affable, utterly certain, a crisis in the kitchen became no more than a humorous sketch. Without him, it was a drama that clutched the heart. He knew most things worth knowing, and when he didn't know, he had a good idea which authority to consult, and would take her into the library to help him find it. If he had not been, as he described it, a slave to the ministry and to eventuality planning, if he had been at home, sending Hardman down for the wines, steering the conversation, deciding, without appearing to, when it was time to go through, she would not be crossing the hallway now with such heaviness in her step. It was these thoughts of him that made her slow as she passed the library door, which unusually was closed. She stopped to listen. From the kitchen, the chink of metal against porcelain, from the drawing room, her mother talking softly, and closer by, one of the twins saying in a high, clear voice, "It's got a U in it, actually," and his brother replying, "I don't care, put it in the envelope." And then, from behind the library door, a scraping noise followed by a thump and a murmur that could have been a man's or a woman's. In memory, and Bryony later gave this matter some thought, she had no particular expectations as she placed her hand on the brass handle and turned it. But she had seen Robbie's letter. She had cast herself as her sister's protector, and she had been instructed by her cousin. What she saw must have been shaped in part by what she already knew, or believed she knew. At first, when she pushed open the door and stepped in, she saw nothing at all. The only light was from a single green glass desk lamp, which illuminated little more than the tooled leather surface on which it stood. When she took another few steps, she saw them. Dark shapes in the furthest corner. Though they were immobile, her immediate understanding was that she had interrupted an attack, a hand-to-hand fight. The scene was so entirely a realization of her worst fears that she sensed that her over-anxious imagination had projected the figures onto the packed spines of books. This illusion, or hope of one, was dispelled as her eyes adjusted to the gloom. No one moved. Bryony stared past Robbie's shoulder into the terrified eyes of her sister. He had turned to look back at the intruder, but he did not let Cecilia go. He had pushed his body against hers, pushing her dress right up above her knee, and had trapped her where the shelves met at right angles. His left hand was behind her neck, gripping her hair, and with his right he held a forearm which was raised in protest or self-defense. He looked so huge and wild, and Cecilia, with her bare shoulders and thin arms, so frail, that Bryony had no idea what she could achieve as she started to go toward them. She wanted to shout, but she could not catch her breath, and her tongue was slow and heavy. Robbie moved in such a way that her view of her sister was completely obscured. Then Cecilia was struggling free, and he was letting her go. Bryony stopped and said her sister's name. When she pushed past Bryony, there was no sign in Cecilia of gratitude or relief. Her face was expressionless, almost composed, and she looked right ahead to the door she was about to leave by. Then she was gone, and Bryony was left alone with him. He too would not meet her eye. Instead, he faced into the corner and busied himself straightening his jacket and arranging his tie. Warily, she moved backward away from him, but he made no move to attack her and did not even look up. So she turned and ran from the room to find Cecilia. But the hallway was empty, and it was not clear which way she had gone. Chapter 11. Despite the late addition of chopped fresh mint to a blend of melted chocolate, egg yolk, coconut milk, rum, gin, crushed banana and icing sugar, the cocktail was not particularly refreshing. Appetites already cloyed by the night's heat were further diminished. Nearly all the adults entering the airless dining room were nauseated by the prospect of a roast dinner, or even roast meat with salad, and would have been content with a glass of cool water. But water was available only to the children, while the rest were to revive themselves with a dessert wine at room temperature. Three bottles stood ready opened at the table. In Jack Tallis's absence, Betty usually made an inspired guess. None of the three tall windows would open because their frames had warped long ago, and an aroma of warmed dust from the Persian carpet rose to meet the diners as they entered. One comfort was that the fishmonger's van bringing the first course of dressed crab had broken down. The effect of suffocation was heightened by the dark-stained panelling reaching from the floor and covering the ceiling, and by the room's only painting, a vast canvas that hung above a fireplace unlit since its construction. A fault in the architectural drawings had left no provision for a flue or chimney. The portrait, in the style of Gainsborough, showed an aristocratic family, parents, two teenage girls, and an infant, all thin-lipped and pale as ghouls, posed before a vaguely Tuscan landscape. No one knew who these people were, but it was likely that Harry Tallis thought they would lend an impression of solidity to his household. Emily stood at the head of the table, placing the diners as they came in. She put Leon on her right and Paul Marshall on her left. To his right, Leon had Bryony and the twins, while Marshall had Cecilia on his left, then Robbie, then Lola. Robbie stood behind his chair, gripping it for support, amazed that no one appeared to hear his still thudding heart. He had escaped the cocktail, but he too had no appetite. He turned slightly to face away from Cecilia, and as the others took their places, noted with relief that he was seated down among the children. Prompted by a nod from his mother, Leon muttered a short suspended grace. "For what we are about to receive, to which the scrape of chairs was the amen. The silence that followed as they settled and unfolded their napkins would easily have been dispersed by Jack Tallis introducing some barely interesting topic, while Betty went around with the beef. Instead, the diners watched and listened to her as she stooped, murmuring at each place, scraping the serving spoon and fork across the silver platter. What else could they attend to, when the only other business in the room was their own silence? Emily Tallis had always been incapable of small talk and didn't much care. Leon, entirely at one with himself, lolled in his chair, wine bottle in hand, studying its label. Cecilia was lost to the events of 10 minutes before and could not have composed a simple sentence. Robbie was familiar with the household and would have started something off, but he too was in turmoil. It was enough that he could pretend to ignore Cecilia's bare arm at his side. He could feel its heat, and the hostile gaze of Bryony, who sat diagonally across from him. And even if it had been considered proper for children to introduce a topic, they too would have been incapable. Bryony could think only of what she had witnessed. Lola was subdued, both by the shock of physical assault and an array of contradictory emotions, and the twins were absorbed in a plan. It was Paul Marshall who broke more than 3 minutes of asphyxiating silence. He moved back in his chair to speak behind Cecilia's head to Robbie. "I say, are we still on for tennis tomorrow?" There was a 2-inch scratch, Robbie noticed, from the corner of Marshall's eye, running parallel to his nose, drawing attention to the way his features were set high up in his face, bunched up under the eyes. Only fractions of an inch kept him from cruel good looks. Instead, his appearance was absurd. The empty tract of his chin was at the expense of a worried, overpopulated forehead. Out of politeness, Robbie too had moved back in his seat to hear the remark, but even in his state, he flinched. It was inappropriate, at the beginning of the meal, for Marshall to turn away from his hostess and begin a private conversation. Robbie said tersely, "I suppose we are." And then, to make amends for him, added for general consideration, "Has England ever been hotter?" Leaning away from the field of Cecilia's body warmth and averting his eyes from Bryony's, he found himself pitching the end of his question into the frightened gaze of Pierrot, diagonally to his left. The boy gaped and struggled, as he might in the classroom, with a test in history. Or was it geography? Or science? Bryony leaned over Jackson to touch Pierrot's shoulder, all the while keeping her eyes on Robbie. "Please leave him alone," she said in a forceful whisper, and then to the little boy softly, "You don't have to answer." Emily spoke up from her end of the table. "Bryony, it was a perfectly bland remark about the weather. You'll apologise or go now to your room." Whenever Mrs. Tallis exercised authority in the absence of her husband, the children felt obliged to protect her from seeming ineffectual. Bryony, who in any case would not have left her sister undefended, lowered her head and said to the tablecloth, "I'm very sorry. I wish I hadn't said it." The vegetables in lidded serving dishes, or on platters of faded spode, were passed up and down, and such was the collective inattention, or the polite desire to conceal a lack of appetite, that most ended with roast potatoes and potato salad, Brussels sprouts and beetroot, and lettuce leaves foundering in gravy. "The old man's not going to be too pleased," Leon said as he got to his feet. "It's a 1921 Barsac, but it's open now." He filled his mother's glass, then his sister's and Marshall's, and when he was standing by Robbie, he said, "And a healing draught for the good doctor. I want to hear about this new plan." But he did not wait for a reply. On his way back to his seat, he said, "I love England in a heat wave. It's a different country. All the rules change." Emily Tallis picked up her knife and fork, and everyone did likewise. Paul Marshall said. Nonsense. Name a single rule that changes. All right. At the club, the only place one's allowed to remove one's jacket is the billiard room. But if the temperature reaches 90 degrees before 3 o'clock, then jackets can be taken off in the upstairs bar the following day. The following day? A different country indeed. You know what I mean. People are more at ease, a couple of days' sunshine and we become Italians. Last week in Charlotte Street, they were eating dinner at pavement tables. It was always the view of my parents, Emily said, that hot weather encouraged loose morals among young people. Fewer layers of clothing, 1,000 more places to meet. Out of doors, out of control. Your grandmother especially was uneasy when it was summer. She would dream up 1,000 reasons to keep my sisters and me in the house. Well then, Leon said, what do you think, C? Have you behaved even worse than usual today? All eyes were on her, and the brotherly banter was relentless. Good heavens, you're blushing. The answer must be yes. Sensing that he should step in for her, Robbie started to say, actually, but Cecilia spoke up. I'm awfully hot, that's all, and the answer is yes, I behave very badly. I persuaded Emily against her will that we should have a roast in your honour regardless of the weather. Now you're sticking to salad while the rest of us are suffering because of you. So pass him the vegetables, Bryony, and perhaps he'll pipe down. Robbie thought he heard a tremor in her voice. Good old C, top form, Leon said. Marshall said, that's put you in your place. I suppose I'd better pick on someone smaller. Leon smiled at Bryony by his side. Have you done something bad today on account of the terrible heat? Have you broken the rules? Please tell us you have. He took her hand in mock beseeching, but she pulled it away.
This ends Disc 4. Atonement, Disc 5.
She was still a child, Robbie thought, not beyond confessing or blurting out that she had read his note, which in turn could lead her to describe what she had interrupted. He was watching her closely as she played for time, taking her napkin, dabbing her lips, but he felt no particular dread. If it had to, let it happen. However appalling, the dinner would not last forever, and he would find a way to be with Cecilia again that night, and together they would confront the extraordinary new fact in their lives, their changed lives, and resume. At the thought, his stomach plunged. Until that time, everything was shadowy irrelevance, and he was afraid of nothing. He took a deep pull of the sugary, lukewarm wine and waited. Bryony said, "It's boring of me, but I've done nothing wrong today." He had underestimated her. The emphasis could only have been intended for him and her sister. Jackson, at her elbow, spoke out. "Oh, yes, you have. You wouldn't let there be a play. We wanted to be in the play." The boy looked around the table, his green eyes shining with the grievance. "And you said you wanted us to." His brother was nodding. "Yes, you wanted us to be in it." No one could know the extent of their disappointment. "There, you see," Leon said, "Bryony's hot-headed decision. On a cooler day, we'd be in the library watching the theatricals now." These harmless inanities, far preferable to silence, allowed Robbie to retreat behind a mask of amused attention. Cecilia's left hand was cupped above her cheek, presumably to exclude him from her peripheral vision. By appearing to listen to Leon, who was now recounting his glimpse of the King in a West End theatre, Robbie was able to contemplate her bare arm and shoulder, and while he did so, he thought she could feel his breath on her skin, an idea which stirred him. At the top of her shoulder was a little dent, scalloped in the bone, or suspended between two bones, with a fuzz of shadow along its rim. His tongue would soon trace the oval of this rim and push into the hollow. His excitement was close to pain and sharpened by the pressure of contradictions. She was familiar like a sister. She was exotic like a lover. He had always known her. He knew nothing about her. She was plain. She was beautiful. She was capable. How easily she protected herself against her brother. And 20 minutes ago she had wept. His stupid letter repelled her, but it unlocked her. He regretted it, and he exulted in his mistake. They would be alone together soon, with more contradictions, hilarity and sensuousness, desire and fear at their recklessness, awe and impatience to begin. In an unused room somewhere on the second floor, or far from the house beneath the trees by the river. Which? Mrs. Tallis's mother was no fool. Outdoors. They would wrap themselves in the satin darkness and begin again. And this was no fantasy, this was real. This was his near future, both desirable and unavoidable. But that was what wretched Malvolio thought, whose part he had played once on the college lawn. Nothing that can be can come between me and the full prospect of my hopes. Half an hour before, there had been no hope at all. After Bryony had disappeared into the house with his letter, he kept on walking, agonizing about turning back. Even when he reached the front door, his mind was not made up, and he loitered several minutes under the porch lamp and its single faithful moth, trying to choose the less disastrous of two poor options. It came down to this. Go in now and face her anger and disgust, give an explanation, which would not be accepted, and most likely be turned away. Unbearable humiliation. Or go home now without a word, leaving the impression that the letter was what he intended. Be tortured all night and for days to come by brooding, knowing nothing of her reaction. Even more unbearable. And spineless. He went over it again, and it looked the same. There was no way out. He would have to speak to her. He put his hand over the bell push. Still, it remained tempting to walk away. He could write her an apology from the safety of his study. Coward. The cool porcelain was under the tip of his forefinger, and before the arguments could start around again, he made himself press it. He stood back from the door, feeling like a man who had just swallowed a suicide pill. Nothing to do but wait. From inside he heard steps, staccato female steps across the hall. When she opened the door, he saw the folded note in her hand. For several seconds they continued to stare at each other, and neither spoke. For all his hesitation, he had prepared nothing to say. His only thought was that she was even more beautiful than his fantasies of her. The silk dress she wore seemed to worship every curve and dip of her lithe body, but the small, sensual mouth was held tight in disapproval, or perhaps even disgust. The house lights behind her were strong in his eyes, making it hard to read her precise expression. Finally, he said, "See, it was a mistake." "A mistake?" Voices reached him across the hallway through the open door of the drawing room. He heard Leon's voice, then Marshall's. It may have been fear of interruption that caused her to step back and open the door wider for him. He followed her across the hall into the library, which was in darkness, and waited by the door while she searched for the switch of a desk lamp. When it came on, he pushed the door closed behind him. He guessed that in a few minutes he would be walking back across the park toward the bungalow. "It wasn't the version I intended to send." "No. I put the wrong one in the envelope." "Yes." He could gauge nothing by these terse replies, and he was still unable to see her expression clearly. She moved beyond the light, down past the shelves. He stepped further into the room, not quite following her, but unwilling to let her out of close range. She could have sent him packing from the front door, and now there was a chance of giving an explanation before he left. She said, "Bryony read it." Oh, God, I'm sorry. He had been about to conjure for her a private moment of exuberance, a passing impatience with convention, a memory of reading the Aureoli edition of Lady Chatterley's Lover, which he had bought under the counter in Soho. But this new element, the innocent child, put his lapse beyond mitigation. It would have been frivolous to go on. He could only repeat himself, this time in a whisper. "I'm sorry." She was moving further away toward the corner into deeper shadow. Even though he thought she was recoiling from him, he took another couple of steps in her direction. "It was a stupid thing. You were never meant to read it. No one was." Still, she shrank away. One elbow was resting on the shelves, and she seemed to slide along them, as though about to disappear between the books. He heard a soft, wet sound, the kind that is made when one is about to speak and the tongue unglues from the roof of the mouth. But she said nothing. It was only then that it occurred to him that she might not be shrinking from him, but drawing him with her, deeper into the gloom. From the moment he had pressed the bell, he had nothing to lose. So he walked toward her slowly as she slipped back, until she was in the corner where she stopped and watched him approach. He too stopped, less than 4 feet away. He was close enough now, and there was just enough light to see she was tearful and trying to speak. For the moment it was not possible, and she shook her head to indicate that he should wait. She turned aside and made a steeple of her hands to enclose her nose and mouth, and pressed her fingers into the corners of her eyes. She brought herself under control and said, "It's been there for weeks." Her throat constricted and she had to pause. Instantly he had an idea what she meant, but he pushed it away. She drew a deep breath, then continued more reflectively. "Perhaps it's months. I don't know. But today, all day it's been strange. I mean, I've been seeing strangely, as if for the first time. Everything has looked different, too sharp, too real. Even my own hands look different. At other times I seem to be watching events as if they happened long ago, and all day I've been furious with you and with myself. I thought that I'd be perfectly happy never seeing you or speaking to you again. I thought you'd go off to medical school and I'd be happy. I was so angry with you. I suppose it's been a way of not thinking about it. Rather convenient, really." She gave a tense little laugh. He said, "It?" Until now, her gaze had been lowered. When she spoke again, she looked at him. He saw only the glimmer of the whites of her eyes. "You knew before me. Something has happened, hasn't it? And you knew before me. It's like being close up to something so large you don't even see it. Even now I'm not sure I can. But I know it's there." She looked down and he waited. "I know it's there because it made me behave ridiculously. And you, of course. But this morning I've never done anything like that before. Afterward I was so angry about it. Even as it was happening. I told myself I'd given you a weapon to use against me. Then this evening, when I began to understand, well, how could I have been so ignorant about myself and so stupid?" She started, seized by an unpleasant idea. "You do know what I'm talking about. Tell me you do." She was afraid that there was nothing shared at all, that all her assumptions were wrong, and that with her words she had isolated herself further, and he would think she was a fool. He moved nearer. "I do. I know it exactly. But why are you crying? Is there something else?" He thought she was about to broach an impossible obstacle, and he meant, of course, someone. But she didn't understand. She didn't know how to answer, and she looked at him quite flummoxed. Why was she crying? How could she begin to tell him when so much emotion, so many emotions, simply engulfed her? He, in turn, felt that his question was unfair, inappropriate, and he struggled to think of a way of putting it right. They stared at each other in confusion, unable to speak, sensing that something delicately established might slip from them. That they were old friends who had shared a childhood was now a barrier. They were embarrassed before their former selves. Their friendship had become vague and even constrained in recent years, but it was still an old habit, and to break it now in order to become strangers on intimate terms required a clarity of purpose which had temporarily deserted them. For the moment, there seemed no way out with words. He put his hands on her shoulders, and her bare skin was cool to the touch. As their faces drew closer, he was uncertain enough to think she might spring away, or hit him, movie-style, across the cheek with her open hand. Her mouth tasted of lipstick and salt. They drew away for a second. He put his arms around her, and they kissed again with greater confidence. Daringly, they touched the tips of their tongues. And it was then she made the falling, sighing sound, which he realized later marked a transformation. Until that moment, there was still something ludicrous about having a familiar face so close to one's own. They felt watched by their bemused childhood selves. But the contact of tongues, alive and slippery muscle, moist flesh on flesh, and the strange sound it drew from her changed that. This sound seemed to enter him, pierce him down his length, so that his whole body opened up and he was able to step out of himself and kiss her freely. What had been self-conscious was now impersonal, almost abstract. The sighing noise she made was greedy, and made him greedy too. He pushed her hard into the corner between the books. As they kissed, she was pulling at his clothes, plucking ineffectually at his shirt, his waistband. Their heads rolled and turned against one another as their kissing became annoying. She bit him on the cheek, not quite playfully. He pulled away, then moved back, and she bit him hard on his lower lip. He kissed her throat, forcing back her head against the shelves. She pulled his hair and pushed his face down against her breasts. There was some inexpert fumbling until he found her nipple, tiny and hard, and put his mouth around it. Her spine went rigid, then juddered along its length. For a moment he thought she had passed out. Her arms were looped around his head, and when she tightened her grip, he rose through it, desperate to breathe, up to his full height and enfolded her, crushing her head against his chest. She bit him again and pulled at his shirt. When they heard a button ping against the floorboards, they had to suppress their grins and look away. Comedy would have destroyed them. She trapped his nipple between her teeth. The sensation was unbearable. He tilted her face up, and trapping her against his ribs, kissed her eyes and parted her lips with his tongue. Her helplessness drew from her again the sound like a sigh of disappointment. At last they were strangers. Their pasts were forgotten. They were also strangers to themselves, who had forgotten who or where they were. The library door was thick, and none of the ordinary sounds that might have reminded them, might have held them back, could reach them. They were beyond the present, outside time, with no memories and no future. There was nothing but obliterating sensation, thrilling and swelling, and the sound of fabric on fabric and skin on fabric as their limbs slid across each other in this restless, sensuous wrestling. His experience was limited, and he knew only at second hand that they need not lie down. As for her, beyond all the films she had seen and all the novels and lyrical poems she had read, she had no experience at all. Despite these limitations, it did not surprise them how clearly they knew their own needs. They were kissing again. Her arms were clasped behind his head. She was licking his ear, then biting his earlobe. Cumulatively, these bites aroused him and enraged him, goaded him. Under her dress, he felt for her buttocks and squeezed hard, and half turned her to give her a retaliatory slap. But there wasn't quite the space. Keeping her eyes fixed on his, she reached down to remove her shoes. There was more fumbling now, with buttons and positioning of legs and arms. She had no experience at all. Without speaking, he guided her foot onto the lowest shelf. They were clumsy, but too selfless now to be embarrassed. When he lifted the clinging, silky dress again, he thought her look of uncertainty mirrored his own. But there was only one inevitable end, and there was nothing they could do but go toward it. Supported against the corner by his weight, she once again clasped her hands behind his neck and rested her elbows on his shoulder and continued to kiss his face. The moment itself was easy. They held their breath before the membrane parted, and when it did, she turned away quickly but made no sound. It seemed to be a point of pride. They moved closer, deeper, and then, for seconds on end, everything stopped. Instead of an ecstatic frenzy, there was stillness. They were stilled not by the astonishing fact of arrival, but by an awed sense of return. They were face to face in the gloom, staring into what little they could see of each other's eyes, and now it was the impersonal that dropped away. Of course, there was nothing abstract about a face. The son of Grace and Ernest Turner, the daughter of Emily and Jack Tallis, the childhood friends, the university acquaintances, in a state of expansive, tranquil joy, confronted the momentous change they had achieved. The closeness of a familiar face was not ludicrous. It was wondrous. Robbie stared at the woman, the girl he had always known, thinking the change was entirely in himself, and was as fundamentally biological as birth. Nothing as singular or as important had happened since the day of his birth. She returned his gaze, struck by the sense of her own transformation and overwhelmed by the beauty in a face which a lifetime's habit had taught her to ignore. She whispered his name with the deliberation of a child trying out the distinct sounds. When he replied with her name, it sounded like a new word. The syllables remained the same. The meaning was different. Finally, he spoke the three simple words that no amount of bad art or bad faith can ever quite cheapen. She repeated them, with exactly the same slight emphasis on the second word, as though she had been the one to say them first. He had no religious belief, but it was impossible not to think of an invisible presence or witness in the room, and that these words spoken aloud were like signatures on an unseen contract. They had been motionless for perhaps as long as half a minute. Longer would have required the mastery of some formidable tantric art. They began to make love against the library shelves, which creaked with their movement. It is common enough at such times to fantasize arriving in a remote and high place. He imagined himself strolling on a smooth, rounded mountain summit, suspended between two higher peaks. He was in an unhurried, reconnoitering mood, with time to go to a rocky edge and take a glimpse of the near vertical scree down which he would shortly have to throw himself. It was a temptation to leap into clear space now, but he was a man of the world and he could walk away and wait. It was not easy, for he was being drawn back and he had to resist. As long as he did not think of the edge, he would not go near it and would not be tempted. He forced himself to remember the dullest things he knew. Bootblack, an application form, a wet towel on his bedroom floor. There was also an upturned dustbin lid with an inch of rainwater inside, and the incomplete tea-ring stain on the cover of his Hausmann poems. This precious inventory was interrupted by the sound of her voice. She was calling to him, inviting him, murmuring in his ear. Exactly so. They would jump together. He was with her now, peering into an abyss, and they saw how the scree plunged down through the cloud cover. Hand in hand, they would fall backward. She repeated herself, mumbling in his ear, and this time he heard her clearly. Someone's come in. He opened his eyes. It was a library in a house, in total silence. He was wearing his best suit. Yes, it all came back to him with relative ease. He strained to look over his shoulder and saw only the dimly illuminated desk, there as before, as though remembered from a dream. From where they were in their corner, it was not possible to see the door. But there was no sound, not a thing. She was mistaken. He was desperate for her to be mistaken, and she actually was. He turned back to her and was about to tell her so when she tightened a grip on his arm and he looked back once more. Bryony moved slowly into their view, stopped by the desk and saw them. She stood there stupidly, staring at them, her arms hanging loose at her sides, like a gunslinger in a Western showdown. In that shrinking moment, he discovered that he had never hated anyone until now. It was a feeling as pure as love, but dispassionate and icily rational. There was nothing personal about it, for he would have hated anyone who came in. There were drinks in the drawing room or on the terrace, and that was where Bryony was supposed to be with her mother and the brother she adored and the little cousins. There was no good reason why she should be in the library, except to find him and deny him what was his. He saw it clearly, how it had happened. She had opened a sealed envelope to read his note and been disgusted, and in her obscure way felt betrayed. She had come looking for her sister, no doubt with the exhilarated notion of protecting her or admonishing her, and had heard a noise from behind the closed library door. Propelled from the depths of her ignorance, silly imagining and girlish rectitude, she had come to call a halt. And she hardly had to do that. Of their own accord, they had moved apart and turned away, and now both were discreetly straightening their clothes. It was over. The main course plates had long been cleared away, and Betty had returned with the bread and butter pudding. Was it imagining on his part, Robbie wondered, or malign intent on hers that made the adults' portions appear twice the size of the children's? Leon was pouring from the third bottle of Barsac. He had removed his jacket, thus allowing the other two men to do the same. There was a soft tapping on the window panes as various flying creatures of the night threw themselves against the glass. Mrs. Tallis dabbed at her face with a napkin and looked fondly at the twins. Pierrot was whispering in Jackson's ear. "No secrets at the dinner table, boys. We'd all like to hear, if you don't mind." Jackson, the delegated voice, swallowed hard. His brother stared at his lap. "We'd like to be excused, Aunt Emily. Please can we go to the lavatory?" "Of course. But it's may, not can, and there's no need to be quite so specific." The twins slipped from their chairs. As they reached the door, Bryony squealed and pointed. "My socks! They're wearing my strawberry socks!" The boys halted and turned and looked in shame from their ankles to their aunt. Bryony was half standing. Robbie assumed that powerful emotions in the girl were finding release. "You went in my room and took them from my drawer." Cecilia spoke for the first time during the meal. She too was venting deeper feelings. "Shut up, for goodness sake. You really are a tiresome little prima donna. The boys had no clean socks, so I took some of yours." Bryony stared at her, amazed. Attacked, betrayed by the one she only longed to protect. Jackson and Piero were still looking toward their aunt, who dismissed them now with a quizzical tilt of her head and a faint nod. They closed the door behind them with exaggerated, perhaps even satirical, care, and at the moment they released the handle, Emily picked up her spoon, and the company followed her. She said mildly, "You could be a little less expressive toward your sister." As Cecilia turned toward her mother, Robbie caught a whiff of her underarm perspiration, which put him in mind of freshly cut grass. Soon they would be outside. Briefly he closed his eyes. A 2-pint jug of custard was placed beside him, and he wondered that he had the strength to lift it. "I'm sorry, Emily, but she has been quite over the top all day long." Bryony spoke with adult calm. "That's pretty strong coming from you."
"Meaning what?"
That, Robbie knew, was not the question to ask. At this stage in her life, Bryony inhabited an ill-defined transitional space between the nursery and adult worlds, which she crossed and recrossed unpredictably. In the present situation, she was less dangerous as an indignant little girl. In fact, Bryony herself had no clear idea of what she meant, but Robbie could not know this as he moved in quickly to change the subject. He turned to Lola on his left and said in a way that was intended to include the whole table, "They're nice lads, your brothers."
"Ha!"
Bryony was savage and did not give her cousin time to speak.
"That shows what little you know."
Emily put down her spoon.
"Darling, if this continues, I must ask you to leave the table."
"But look what they did to her, scratched her face and gave her a Chinese burn."
All eyes were on Lola. Her complexion pulsed darker beneath her freckles, making her scratch appear less vivid. Robbie said, "It doesn't look too bad." Bryony glared at him. Her mother said, "Little boy's fingernails. We should get you some ointment." Lola appeared brave.
"Actually, I've put some on. It's feeling a lot better already."
Paul Marshall cleared his throat.
"I saw it myself. Had to break it up and pull them off her. I have to say I was surprised, little fellows like that. They went for her all right."
Emily had left her chair. She came to Lola's side and lifted her hands in hers.
"Look at your arms. It's not just chafing. You're bruised up to your elbows. How on earth did they do that?"
"I don't know, Aunt Emily."
Once again, Marshall tilted back in his seat. He spoke behind Cecilia and Robbie's head to the young girl who stared at him as her eyes filled with tears.
"There's no shame in making a fuss, you know. You're awfully brave, but you have taken a bad knock."
Lola was making an effort not to cry. Emily drew her niece toward her midriff and stroked her head. Marshall said to Robbie,
"You're right. They're nice lads, but I suppose they've been through a lot lately."
Robbie wanted to know why Marshall had not mentioned the matter before if Lola had been so badly harmed, but the table was now in commotion. Leon called across to his mother,
"Do you want me to phone a doctor?"
Cecilia was rising from the table. Robbie touched her arm and she turned, and for the first time since the library, their eyes met. There was no time to establish anything beyond the connection itself. Then she hurried round to be by her mother, who began to give instructions for a cold compress. Emily murmured comforting words to the top of her niece's head. Marshall remained in his seat and filled his glass. Bryony also stood up, and as she did so, gave another of her penetrating girlish cries. She took from Jackson's seat an envelope and held it up to show them.
"A letter!"
She was about to open it. Robbie could not prevent himself asking,
"Who's it addressed to?"
"It says to everyone."
Lola disengaged from her aunt and wiped her face with her napkin. Emily drew on a surprising new source of authority.
You will not open it. You will do as you are told and bring it to me.
Bryony caught the unusual tone in her mother's voice and meekly walked round the table with the envelope. Emily took one step away from Lola as she pulled a scrap of lined paper clear. When she read it, Robbie and Cecilia were able to read it too.
We are going to run away because Lola and Betty are horrid to us and we want to go home. Sorry we took some fruit and there wasn't a play.
They had each signed their first names with zigzag flourishes. There was silence after Emily had read it aloud. Lola stood up and took a couple of steps toward a window, then changed her mind and walked back toward the end of the table. She was looking from left to right in a distracted manner and murmuring over and over, "Oh, hell! Oh, hell!" Marshall came and put his hand on her arm. "It's going to be all right. We'll make up some search parties and find them in no time."
"Absolutely," Leon said. "They've only been gone a few minutes."
But Lola was not listening and seemed to have made up her mind. As she strode toward the door, she said, "Mummy will kill me." When Leon tried to take her by her shoulder, she shrugged away, and then she was through the door. They heard her running across the hall. Leon turned to his sister.
"See, you and I will go together."
Marshall said, "There's no moon, it's pretty dark out there." The group was moving toward the door, and Emily was saying,
"Someone ought to wait here, and that might as well be me."
Cecilia said,
"There are torches behind the cellar door."
Leon said to his mother, "I think you ought to phone the constable." Robbie was the last to leave the dining room, and the last, he thought, to adjust to the new situation. His first reaction, which did not fade when he stepped into the relative coolness of the hallway, was that he had been cheated. He could not believe that the twins were in danger. The cows would scare them home. The vastness of the night beyond the house, the dark trees, the welcoming shadows, the cool new-mown grass, all this had been reserved. He had designated it as belonging exclusively to himself and Cecilia. It was waiting for them, theirs to use and claim. Tomorrow, or any time other than now, would not do. But suddenly the house had spilled its contents into a night which now belonged to a half-comic domestic crisis. They would be out there for hours, hallooing and waving their torches. The twins would eventually be found tired and dirty. Lola would be calmed down, and after some self-congratulation over nightcaps, the evening would be over. Within days, or even hours, it would have become an amusing memory to be wheeled out on family occasions. The night the twins ran away. The search parties were setting off as he reached the front door. Cecilia had linked arms with her brother, and as they set off, she glanced back and saw him standing in the light. She gave him a look, a shrug, which said, "There's nothing we can do for now." Before he could enact for her some gesture of loving acceptance, she turned, and she and Leon marched on, calling out the boys' names. Marshall was even further ahead, making his way down the main drive, visible only by the torch he held. Lola was not in sight. Bryony was walking around the side of the house. She, of course, would not want to be in Robbie's company, and that was some relief, for he had already decided. If he could not be with Cecilia, if he could not have her to himself, then he too, like Bryony, would go out searching alone. This decision, as he was to acknowledge many times, transformed his life. Chapter 12. However elegant the old Adams-style building had been, however beautifully it once commanded the parkland, the walls could not have been as sturdy as those of the baronial structure that replaced it, and its rooms could never have possessed the same quality of stubborn silence that occasionally smothered the Tallis home.
Emily felt its squat presence now as she closed the front door on the search parties and turned to cross the hall.